Welcome to the back room of politics. As home ownership rates in New Zealand fall and first home buyers are generally older than has been the case in the past, time to accumulate a deposit has been progressively pushed as the supply of new housing to the market has been outstripped by demand. So what are the constraints on that supply? And how much has regulation impacted on that supply and ultimately on the end price? I'm joined today in the back room of politics by Leonie Freeman, CEO of the New Zealand Property Council, a body that represents major housing developers, but also major providers of other forms of accommodation beyond the quarter acre, sort of a dream that New Zealanders once saw part of their legacy. Leonie, welcome to the back room of politics. Tell us a little bit about your background as you came into the job you now have.
Thanks very much, and great to be here, Jerry. Yes, I've spent my whole career in property, actually, and it's a bit scary now when I count up the years because it was just over 30 years since I graduated from Lincoln. I'm a Christchurch person, grew up there. So I've done everything just about in property, from valuation, property management, development, strategy, all sorts of things. I've done startup businesses, so I was actually responsible for what's now realestate.co.nz, and also bought rundown companies and turned them around. But about 10, 12 years ago, after I sold my last business, I wanted to do more and make more of a contribution. So I got involved in the public sector, and I've spent time in local government and central government, both at Housing New Zealand, leading the turnaround of their development program, as well as directly with Minister of Finance at the time, Bill English, on the housing issues. And then in 2016, I launched my own initiative, actually, which was a solution to solve Auckland's housing crisis as a way to try and elevate the discussion and focus on solutions, not just the problems. So it's something very passionate to my heart is housing and how we solve the issue that we have in New Zealand.
Well, it's no surprise that you come from Canterbury. All the great innovators, of course, in New Zealand do come from Canterbury. what was that solution for Auckland? Because it is the biggest centre of population. It's where the price pressure on housing is greatest. And the demand is also obviously greatest.
Absolutely. And I think from my perspective, I come from the private sector, but have spent time in the public sector. And the learnings that I took from that was basically what we were doing wasn't working. And so I did a lot of research and put up a solution called, fundamentally, it's called Collective Impact. And Collective Impact is an initiative that's used extensively all around the world to solve these big, complex, seemingly intractable social problems. And fundamentally, there's three key steps. The first one is about creating a clear vision and outcomes for the city. So, for example, for Auckland, we had a vision for housing for Auckland, and then we had clear targets about saying things like 14,000 houses a year, half of which are affordable, home ownership rates at 65%, including Māori and Pacifica, a certain number of houses at warm, safe and dry, ending homelessness, a zero social housing wait list, and still building communities. Because the thing is, what I find intriguing is we all know there's a problem, but we still do not have a vision and targets for any cities in New Zealand. The second step from that is about saying, okay, if we've got this vision that we're all focused on and heading towards, how do we then get it? And so a collective impact initiative, the only difference to what's going on now and how they've been successfully implemented overseas is about creating a small, usually a non-for-profit entity that acts as the coordinator of all the different stakeholders. So the idea is to bring the government, the local government, central government, the private sector, iwi, the finance community, and the community housing providers all together focused on those outcomes rather than where we are now, where everybody acts in their silos. So it's trying to get everyone rowing the boat in the right direction. And then the third step is about a long-term plan with clear accountability and communication. Because again, one of the challenges is when we've got three-year local government and central government timeframes, that's way too short. So it was about developing 10 to 15-year plans with clear outcomes, clear targets, and that you're bringing everybody together. So it's really looking at a systemic approach to all the issues. A lot of where the media and everybody focuses on what are all the specific things like RMA, like consenting and all that sort of stuff, which is still important, but they are a lot of the initiatives that we need to implement all at the same time, but still making sure we're going towards that big vision. So it's sort of turning the system around.
And has that happened that you can observe?
No, not yet. We're still working on it. So what happened was when we introduced it in 2016, we had a huge amount of support from the private sector, community housing sector, infrastructure, basically most of the people on the delivery side, because they were the ones experiencing the challenges. Unfortunately, from central government and local government, we didn't get the support.
Yeah, well, I think that the other bit that I pick up from what you just said, because I don't disagree with you that it is everybody should be focused on the task here, because it's much bigger than I think is being realised.
Yeah.
And you know, housing has such a huge effect on so many aspects of life in New Zealand. But you use that word affordable. What do you define as being an affordable house? I look at you know, the cost of new properties that are being bought to the market. Yes, the specification is high compared to what it was 30 years ago or before that, but it's expensive relative to the incomes that people are in New Zealand.
Yeah, and I totally agree with you, Jerry. That definition around affordability and what is it is a real challenge. And because it's quite complex, it tends to get set at a particular figure, you know. So here, you know, 650,000 is affordable. So I think what I encourage people to think about with housing is that it's more important to think about affordability across the housing continuum. So if you think about the housing continuum, firstly, we need to provide houses at different parts along the continuum. So we need to, you know, solve our homelessness. So we've got transitional housing there. We've got social housing. We've got, you know, that affordable housing to both buy and to rent, and then private housing to buy and to rent. And so then if you look at, if you understand the continuum and think about housing, so what we want is a whole range of different types of housing right across that continuum at different price points, but also at different sizes. And so there's no point just saying, okay, well, we'll build a whole lot of one-bedroom houses, which are the cheapest, or two-bedroom apartments, the cheapest we can build, when actually we still need affordable housing to house large families. So there isn't really a figure as such. The international definitions work on sort of 30% of people's income, which, again, is, you know, a lot of New Zealand is quite unaffordable in that space. But as well as the affordable side, we also need to think about the demand side and how do we also then help, and what are the initiatives we can introduce to help people get into that housing? So, you know, that's things like shared equity schemes. So when people just can't afford a whole 100%, then maybe they can buy a 50% with some of the providers that are doing that, or, you know, to work with specific iwi groups and a whole lot of different places just to provide ways to support people into that. So what we've got to think about there is it's both a supply and a demand issues that we need to address. And there's no, I think this is the key thing, there isn't one solution that's going to fit everyone across anything to do with housing.
What about the incentive side of things? So at the moment, there doesn't seem to be the need for a great deal of incentive. I know that there is first-time buyers, is the you know, the $10,000 plus your KiwiSaver, et cetera, et cetera. Beyond that, there's not a lot. And what I do worry about is the incredible cost of the bureaucracy inside house price. So I appreciate what you're saying about, you know, don't focus on price, but in the end, no matter what type of housing you're trying to provide, there is a price.
Yes.
And if you're looking at new stuff on a that $650,000 figure that you mentioned, and that would be buying something pretty modest that's brand new, the tax component alone on that is going to be very high. GST on its own would be $90,000 at least, a bit more than that inside that amount. So it just does seem to me that there is a big component of the cost of a new build or a new apartment or a new multi-complex building that is, in fact, just a straight take to the tax base.
Yes.
Do you think there's a need to do some work on how that might be better shared as an equity over a period of years?
Yes, and you know, the challenge with housing is that, you know, obviously there's a land component, and that's expensive in its own right, and then you've got the cost of materials. But then on top of that, there is a whole raft of different costs, whether it's consenting and compliance and, like you said, tax. And where I think if we take the tax bit just for as an example, you know, this is where we need to be thinking smarter. So is there an opportunity in that tax bit around the GST? And you know, again, I'm not saying this is right or wrong, but these are the sort of things that really need to be thought through as part of the wider context to understand what would be the consequences if we did it. But what's to stop something like the GST component for a brand new house, say for first home buyers, instead of paying it up front, it's put as something on your title so that when you sell the house, you then pay that GST component, you know, and that would reduce the price of housing for first time purchasers. So, you know, there's a raft of different things that we can look at. And part of the issue that I keep seeing all the time around housing is that we've got lots of people working on stuff, but it's all in silos. And so something happens over here and that creates a whole lot of unintended consequences over here. Whereas if you had the ability to pull the wide range of people involved together and said, okay, you know, how could we, you know, if you take the question you've just raised, how might we be able to reduce the cost over that sort of tax component? What might that look like? And these are the things that we really need to investigate. And the other thing we need to, when we think about a lot of the stuff, is that it is complex and it has major, it can potentially have big unintended consequences. And so I do see the media struggling a lot because they're looking for quick sound bites that they can explain to people rather than really understanding that actually, heck, there's a huge amount of complexity that sits behind it. And, you know, just sort of using housing as I always think it's used as a bit of a political football, but, you know, we just focus on one thing. It's never just one thing. There's probably 20 things that we need to do all at the same time.
It is, but unfortunately at the moment we are stuck with dealing with those silos because we have a government that's more Auckland centric than Canterbury centric. I think we would be able to sort that down here. But, and we did, in fact, after the earthquakes with pretty permissive legislation that allowed us tools that created a lot of residential sections down here very, very quickly.
Yes.
And so whether we like it or not, that's what we've got is what we deal with. And I guess for your members, one of the frustrations must be that long process to get new land made available, but also even in a city commercial building transfer restorations or new builds, it is incredibly complex just to get out of the ground.
Absolutely. And I think that, you know, if you're a residential developer, so just to give you a couple of small examples, if I was doing, say, 20 houses that I was building, and that's not a large development, from way to go, it probably might take me 2 years. But the construction part of that is only about the last 9 to 10 months. So when you actually see something physically happening on the site, it's the 12 to 14 months up front, which is all the work that you do in the background around getting consents and permissions and all that sort of thing. And so if you think about that and say, okay, well, what can we do to reduce that time to speed up delivery of supply? And because that can have a huge impact. If I was doing, a 500 to 1,000 houses, you know, that would take probably 3 years to go through that consenting process before I can start anything on the site. And again, there's a lot of good reasons to make sure, you know, that we build to a good standard and that it's all being done accordingly, you know, safe and dry, and that we're building community facilities and everything. So I'm not suggesting that it's not important to go through that, but it adds a huge cost. And if we could look at how we could pick up the time frame, then any improvement in timeframes can potentially reduce costs, and that'll have a big impact on the final prices.
What do you think will be the most important aspect of the current consideration of resource management law? The plan is to get rid of this amorphous act. It started out with the very simple principle: if you wanted to do something in New Zealand that required land use, then you could, as long as you mitigated against the worst environmental effects. And of course, it's grown now into this huge amorphous sort of piece of legislation that is in many ways too difficult to even understand for many people. So that the idea is to simplify it down. I think the government's proposing three acts. We're not quite sure exactly what's going to be in them, but what would you think for your sector, the construction sector, the most important aspect of that potential change could be?
And, you know, the Randerson report or the Randerson review that was done around the RMA, I thought was a great report, and it did a huge amount of research into what was going on around the RMA, because without a doubt it is very complex. And I think people on both sides, whether you're looking from an environmental side or whether you're looking from a development side, there are issues with current legislation. So I think the process that they've gone through around the review, now they're looking at these different acts. The nobody disagrees with the purpose and the intent. I think where we are concerned is, so how's this actually going to work in practice? On one side, the intent is to be able to build more housing to meet the demand of New Zealanders, and in a reasonable time frame and price, as well as ensuring that we maintain strong and high environmental levels. So I think everybody agrees with the intent. The challenge now is, so how will it actually manifest itself and actually work in practice? Because I can remember, and I was actually at university when the last RMA Act was passed, and so it tells you it was quite a while ago, and I can recall at that time it probably took about 5 years for the industry to really understand what it all meant, because it had, you know, some things had to be tested, and you know, there were some court cases and decisions made. So our biggest concern at the moment is that there is this danger of a real gap between how things are written from a legal perspective to how they then get interpreted from a practical perspective. And so one of the things we've been recommending to government is to say, look, you know, and we've been involved in this quite extensively, is to say, look, you know, we support the intent and what you're trying to do, but before anything is passed or you know, goes out for public consultation, we want to work with government to give them some examples of projects that have actually, you know, gone through a system to test it. So, because my biggest concern with the change in legislation is, I've got two concerns with it. One is that it will actually delay development and increase costs, and that is exactly what we don't want. And the second thing is that there is a myriad of legislative change going on around housing. So the RMA is just one bit. But when I overlay that with the National Policy Statement for Urban Development and other things happening at local councils, you know, what we've got to make sure, again, is that it's all this legislation is joining up to come back to the outcome that we're trying to get, which is, from a housing perspective, to build more housing at affordable prices, because we run the real risk that it might do exactly the opposite.
Yeah, that's a very valid concern, I think. And I do hope the government take you up on that. It seems to be very, very sensible. I remember at one stage looking through what was to be a new plan for Christchurch City here and spending a whole weekend with two people going through volumes of material that had been produced by the local council, all with the best intention. Yep. In the world, but it was not something that you could easily find your way through. And so in conjunction with them, we started again, and we've got reasonably good sort of planned out here now. But the point I make is that, intention is one thing, but unless that intention is given practical life inside a piece of legislation, you are on the back foot. So I'm glad that you've got that involvement with the government on this one.
Yes, and we just think it's so key, because I'd hate to see housing, you know, when we're in such need for housing, to then be slowed down for the next 5 years, you know, while this sort of stuff is figured out. Because again, any delay with developments or housing projects or things like that, it just increases cost. So anything we can do to it, speed it up and improve it and provide certainty, then that's good, you know. And with that is making sure that the development community and everyone involved can sort of move at pace and with certainty.
Rent to build, or build to rent, I should say, is an interesting concept that is starting to be developed in New Zealand. Just tell us how that works. It's sort of something I've thought about how it might work, but I'm not sure that I fully understand it.
Yes. So it's something that people have asked me actually for many years, because often people have been overseas and they've said to me, the only, you know, why don't we have the large institutional owners like, you know, in Europe that own residential accommodation and people can rent them for, you know, decades? Why don't we have that in New Zealand? And a lot of the reason why we haven't had it in New Zealand or don't have it really at any scale is because of returns and tax constraints largely. And so the whole, and Property Council's been leading and working quite closely with the government on this to try and create what we call a build-to-rent sector. So it's effectively a commercial residential sector. So if you look at our listed companies in New Zealand, we've got the likes of Goodman, Precinct, you've got Kiwi with the shopping centres. Now, all of these large listed entities effectively develop and own large-scale industrial office and retail property and then lease it out to customers. But we don't have any large-scale listed companies that do that for residential. And that is what we are trying to create for New Zealand, because we know if we could get the parameters right for that, it won't solve the whole of the housing crisis, but it's another initiative where you would bring a completely different ownership spectrum into housing, and you would, you know, add thousands and thousands of houses into New Zealand. And what it also does on the other side is these large-scale entities are not interested in selling. They're not mum and dad investors who are looking to hold it for a few years and sell it. These are long-term institutional owners who will say, for example, own an entire apartment complex of, say, 200 or 300. They will manage it well, create a community, and people can stay as long as they like. And so that on that will give much greater tenure security for people that are renting.
Isn't the state housing arrangement in New Zealand much the same as that, though?
Yes.
Since 1938, we've had that. So are you talking about a private sector body that is pretty much the same as our state sector at the moment?
Yes. So if you take, you know, Kāinga Ora now, they are effectively a large-scale you know, build to rent owner, because they don't, you know, they sell off houses at the fringes, but pretty much they build and own a lot of those. What we're trying to do is expand that so that they can cover, you know, the other bits of the housing continuum, so that you can have build to rent by the community housing providers, build to rent in the affordable sector, and build to rent at the private market end. And so it's about, again, expanding the market, expanding the people that are in it, and just providing long-term rental security for the private clients, you know, as opposed to the social housing ones done by Kāinga Ora.
So Kāinga Ora doesn't pay tax, for example. It's got no impost on it. I'm not convinced that over the years have been all that great a landlord, in actual fact, if you look at some of their properties. But a question would be, what is that tax issue that you spoke of before that could be in the way of some of these large entities being developed in New Zealand? And yes. The other thing is, while you're talking, what is the advantage to a tenant in this type of arrangement into, you know, Mr. and Mrs. XYZ who've got a couple of rental properties in their neighbourhood?
Yeah, so I'll start with that one first. So it's, you know, again, you're still going to have plenty of mum and dad investors. But I think that when you look around the country at the moment and the increasing rental rates, it's highlighting that we actually not only have a shortage of housing across the sector, we have a shortage of rental housing. And there are plenty of mum and dad investors that are long-term and do a great job providing rental accommodation and looking after it and maintaining it. But as you often hear in the media, there are also some where it's a very short-term thing and people wanting to rent can go in and they, you know, the property gets sold or things change. That sector will stay, but where the build to rent will be is that they like the build to rent aren't typically in individual houses. It's more in higher density. So you will see bigger complexes, big apartment developments that the build to rent space will operate. And the difference between going into a standard apartment block where, you know, half the apartments are owner occupied and half are rented, and every apartment that is rented is owned by somebody different, is that you have a whole approach to managing that complex. So it's done as a whole community. There are often more facilities built in for tenants, that there's a different approach. You know, it's like a whole customer service thing. So if you just think for a moment, say, for example, with a shopping centre, you know, most people go into shopping centres and you probably don't think too much about what goes in the background. But a shopping centre is a whole complex in its own right that, you know, like mini cities and or mini communities. And so you've got a whole management thing about how do you best get that shopping centre to work, what are the mix of the tenants and all that sort of thing. If you've got build to rent with these large apartment complexes, it will get managed in the same way. And so much more as a holistic building, community, all that sort of thing. But the key thing really, which is for some tenants what they want, is for long-term tenure, because not everybody, you know, wants to own their own home. But if you went into one of these build to rent programs, assuming you look after it and you pay your rent, of course, but you know, you'd be able to stay there 10 or 20 years if that's what you really wanted, without the worry that it could be sold. And that is one of the differences that we just don't have at the moment.
Would the build-to-rent operators expect that they might be able to expense interest costs in their arrangements? I mean, you expect these things to be profitable, shopping complexes generally are.
Yep.
They are also often debt-funded. And so the profit comes after the expense of funding that debt, and that expense is deductible at the moment. For the mum and dad investor, and for any investor, in fact, in residential property, that deduction has been taken away.
Yes, absolutely. So there's a couple of key areas that we're looking at. One is about the overseas investor, because at the moment there's quite restrictions around overseas investment in residential. So we need to think about making, you know, there's a lot of interest here in the build-to-rent space, and there's a lot of capital available for these sorts of developments. But if you look at a lot of our listed companies in New Zealand, because you've got shareholding all around the world, they aren't necessarily seen as being owned by, you know, they're not always New Zealand entities. So it's about how do we deal with the overseas investment perspective. And the second one, as you touched on, was around the interest deductibility. And I think one of the things that we are seeing now is with some of these larger entities, and if I just take, say, the shopping centre, for example, and I'll give you an example of Sylvia Park in Auckland, for those that have been there, and it's a large retail complex in Auckland. Where the sort of shift for Kiwi Property has gone is from just building great big shopping centres to saying, look, what we actually do now is we create communities. So at Sylvia Park now is a big office tower. And so you've got all the retail, you've got the transport nodes and networks, you've got an office for where people work, and they also want to build apartments. And so you're seeing, rather than a lot of the property being split by particular sectors, you are seeing a lot of people looking at how do we build these greater communities where people can live and work and shop and have entertainment and all the other, you know, facilities. And so that's the sort of the shift, and that's where we're sort of trying to create the opportunity in New Zealand, pretty much like, you know, Europe's had for many years. Australia's been doing a lot of build to rent in the last decade. England's been doing it for, you know, last 15 to 20 years. So it's not going to solve the whole problem, but it would bring another lot of thousands and thousands of homes into the market that it wouldn't have normally.
Is there an international figure available that would give you an indication of the rent to value on those type of properties? In other words, if an apartment is built and it's got a build cost of, say, $400,000, what is the expected rental on that? 5% would be $20,000, so it's quite cheap, but you'd expect it would be quite a bit more than that.
Yeah, no, look, I don't think there are standard figures, because it depends on, you know, some of the buildings. So you could imagine, for example, that You know, they might do a build to rent complex, which is a really high standard, and you might have a concierge and all the extra facilities. And then in other places, you might have, you know, that they would gear some at to be at a more affordable space. So, yeah, I'm not aware of exact sort of figures like that, but it's all about identifying, you know, location of sites, who would be the likely, what would be the likely demand for those apartment complexes, and then developing your building around that with all the facilities. But what you do see overseas is whether it's at that more of an affordable end or whether it's at a, you know, a top end, the whole thing that they try to do is they're basically creating mini communities. So on top of just having a place to live, there's a lot put into shared facilities, ways to bring all the tenants together and to create the sense of community within these buildings rather than often an apartment you don't even know your neighbours.
If you had a wish list, then looking at everything we've talked about this afternoon, it seems to me it would start with better planning, better integration of everybody who's involved in the housing issue, and then a bit of innovative thinking about what is actually needed to be provided, what's the shape of families in the future, what is going to be the needs of communities in the future. Anything else that you'd add to that?
I think at a really high level, that's a great synopsis, because I suppose, you know, I've worked in the space for quite a while, and I keep thinking to myself, you know, how worse does this have to get before we as a country are going to say we've got to take a totally different approach to solving it? And, you know, it's the thing is that whilst government's important and council's important and every sector involved is important, nobody by themselves can solve this. And, you know, we need to realise as communities and as a city that this is a big issue we've got to solve.
Well, Yanni, as someone who's got kids who attempt to get into the market, I totally empathise with what you're saying. And I'm sure that many, many New Zealanders would feel the same. So while it's wonderful to think that we individually have got very high-value houses, the reality is it's all quite false if some of us just stand up, simply cannot get there or live the way we want. So, Yanni, can I thank you very much for your time and wish the Property Council well in your discussions with the government, and particularly you with being able to get some of your ideas across as well.
Thanks very much. Great to be here.